Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford with Marvin Gaye. In background, welcome you to the July 14th Bastille Day edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Last Tuesday morning, I was on my way to Washington, D.C. to moderate and participate the following day on a panel discussion at the International Spy Museum on the subject of Israel's nuclear arsenal and the strategic implications of Washington's unwillingness to admit their existence. Today, at about 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be interviewing one of my fellow panelists, Sasha Polakoff-Saransky, whose new book, The Unspoken Alliance, Israel's Secret Relations with Apartheid South Africa, exposes new layers of that relationship, including the sharing of nuclear weaponry. By coincidence, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also came to town the day I arrived to make sure that Washington's code of silence about Israel's nukes remained intact. On his last trip to Washington in March, Netanyahu had been rudely treated by the president, who was disgusted with the announcement of a major Jewish settlement expansion that had greeted Vice President Biden upon his arrival in Israel the previous week. That Netanyahu had not been formally invited to Washington at the time, but was in town for the annual AIPAC convention, was not given a moment's consideration. For not having received the Israeli Prime Minister with all the proper diplomatic flourishes, however, Obama was taken to task by the East Coast dailies and Jewish news weeklies. Now, almost 4 months later, in the midst of an election season, the president was taking no chances that he might offend either major Jewish donors, or who are the Democrats' lifeline, or Jewish voters whose choices are critical in a half a dozen states. Obama's performance under the circumstances was not one that would make Americans or his supporters proud. Under the telling headline, quote, "Alliance or Dysfunctional Relationship?" question mark. The Washington Post's Dana Milbank described the scene the next day, quote, "A blue and white Israeli flag hung from Blair House. Across Pennsylvania Avenue, the Stars and Stripes was in its usual place atop the White House. But to capture the real significance of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's visit with President Obama, White House officials might have instead flown the white flag of surrender." 4 months ago, Milbank wrote, the Obama administration made a politically perilous decision to condemn Israel over a controversial new settlement. The Israel lobby reared up. Netanyahu denounced the administration's actions, Republican leaders sided with Netanyahu, and Democrats ran for cover. So on Tuesday, Obama, routed and humiliated by his Israeli counterpart, invited Netanyahu back to the White House for what might be called the Oil of Olay Summit. It was all about saving face. Obama came to office, Milbank recalled, with an admirable hope of reviving Middle East peace efforts by appealing to the Arab world and positioning himself as more of an honest broker. But he has now learned the painful lesson that domestic politics won't allow such a stand. End quote. That was Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. Not surprisingly, the pro-Israel monitoring group, CAMRA, or Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, raked him over the coals the next day as they did the Post News report of the Obama-Netanyahu meeting. One of CAMRA's points of criticism was that there was no mention by either Milbank or the Post reporters of a critical Obama statement regarding, but of course not mentioning, Israel's nukes. Ironically, this more than proved Milbank's point, even as the president, for a brief moment, seemed to think he was speaking for Israel. Quote, "Oh, President Obama, there is no change in U.S. policy when it comes to these issues," he said. "We strongly believe that given its size, its history, the region that it's in, and the threats that are leveled against us," against it, he corrected himself, "that Israel has unique security requirements. It's got to be able to respond to threats of any combination of threats in the region, and that's why," intoned the president, "we remain unwavering in our commitment to Israel's security. And the United States will never ask Israel to take any steps that would undermine their security interests," end quote. Even, I should add, if they jeopardize American security interests. The convener and one of the other speakers on my Washington panel was Grant Smith, director of IRMAP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, who has twice been a guest on Takes on the World. On my last trip to Washington this past November, I joined Grant when he visited the Foreign Agents Registration Agency of the Department of Justice and presented the agency with 362 pages of evidence supporting his contention that AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, should be obliged to register as a foreign agent as is required of the lobbyists of every other foreign country. At the moment, while registered as a lobby for Israel, AIPAC insists that it acts independently of Tel Aviv. An article in the Israeli newspaper Yediot Ahronot last Tuesday seemed to dispute that. A few days ago, according to the article, AIPAC's top brass visited Israel. AIPAC leaders met with Netanyahu and other ministers. They agreed that once the settlement freeze period ends, Israel will engage in restrained, moderate construction in the West Bank and report to AIPAC accurately and in advance on every house or balcony to be built, end quote. That sounds like collusion to me, but when Israel has repeatedly gotten away with murder, what's a little duplicity on the side? They have not received the notoriety of General Stanley McChrystal's ill-chosen comments to a Rolling Stone reporter, but his successor, General David Petraeus, may come to be haunted, or should come to be haunted, by an email he copied to someone who is even more obsessed than I am with what Israel and his friends are doing to America. You may recall that there was a report that I cited some weeks ago in an earlier program that senior figures in the American military, including Petraeus, had identified Israel's continued occupation of Palestinian land as an obstacle to resolving both the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. Although such criticism was contained in the written report that the general presented to the Senate Armed Forces Committee, his spoken testimony did not mention it. Nevertheless, Petraeus soon came under attack by JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, and from the stable of former generals and admirals it maintains who are ready to do Israel's bidding, from the neocons whose columns contaminate the mainstream media and Sunday talk shows, and to be sure, the Jewish news weeklies previously mentioned. On the basis of his prepared statement, some on the right and the left, including yours truly, wrongly assumed he had suddenly and bravely decided to stand up to the Israel lobby inside the United States. But guess what? In a gaffe that has yet to attract the same amount of press as McChrystal's interview with Rolling Stone, but did make London's New Statesman magazine, Petraeus accidentally leaked an email exchange of his with the neocon pro-Israel columnist Max Boot to an activist named James Morris in Los Angeles, who then passed it on to the blogger Philip Weiss. The email showed Petraeus encouraging Boot, who is a regular contributor to the neocon journal Commentary, to write a story and offering Boot choice details about Petraeus' views on the Holocaust. "Does it help," Petraeus wrote to him, "if folks know that I hosted Eli Wiesel and his wife at our quarters last Sunday night, and that I will be the speaker at the 65th anniversary of the liberation of the concentration camps in mid-April at the Capitol Dome?" End quote. This led the Statesman columnist, New Statesman columnist, Mehdi Hassan, to conclude that, quote, "The good general is keener on becoming the next U.S. president and not upsetting the Israel lobby in the meantime than some had assumed," end quote. Will Petraeus' craven desire for the approval of the Zionist establishment come back to bite him, as did McChrystal's comments to Rolling Stone? Don't bet on it. While I was in Washington, I had the pleasure of having lunch with Helen Thomas in the apartment in which she has lived since 1973, and which she rarely strays these days after having been fired from her position as a columnist for the Hearst newspapers after 60 years in covering the White House. Thomas, who will celebrate her 90th birthday on August 4th, made an offhand response to a rabbi with a video camera this past May, who asked the former dean of White House journalists what her solution was to the Israel-Palestine conflict. "The Jews," she told the rabbi in the microphone of his video camcorder, "should go back to Germany, to Poland, to America." Rather than putting her comments on YouTube right away, the rabbi waited until after the deadly Israeli attack on the Turkish ship carrying humanitarian aid to Gaza, apparently hoping to switch the focus to Thomas, and to an extent he succeeded. As Glenn Greenwald, a frequent guest on Democracy Now!, pointed out, Thomas's career as a journalist ended when she expressed the exact view about Jews which numerous public figures have expressed with no consequences or even controversy about Palestinians. The day before I had lunch with Thomas, CNN ended the 20-year career of Octavia Nasser, its Atlanta-based senior Middle East news editor, because of a now-deleted tweet she wrote on Sunday upon learning of the death of one of the Shiite world's most beloved religious figures, Sayed Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah. "Sad to hear of the passing of Sayed Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah," she wrote. "One of Hezbollah's giants I respected a lot." Fadlallah, in fact, had no formal connection to Hezbollah, although he was revered by them. But that message, wrote Glenn Greenwald, spawned an intense fit of protest from far-right outlets, thought crime enforcers, and other neocon precincts, and CNN quickly and characteristically capitulated to that pressure by firing her. CNN, which has employed a former AIPAC official, Wolf Blitzer, as its primary news anchor for the last 15 years, justified its actions by claiming that Nasser's quote-unquote credibility had been quote-unquote compromised. As even the AP put it, Fadlallah was, quote, "one of Shiite Islam's highest and most revered religious authorities, with a following that stretched beyond Lebanon's borders to Iraq, the Gulf, and as far away as Central Asia," end quote. Ironically, he was a religious guide for Iraq's Dawa Party, the party of our close ally, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who took the very unusual step of leaving Iraq to attend Fadlallah's funeral. Fadlallah, by the way, was a target of a CIA-sponsored attack in Lebanon in the 80s, which killed 80 civilian people, civilian Lebanese. Anyway, the power of the Zionist establishment is, of course, not limited to the United States. In the UK, where each of the major parties has, a quote, a Friends of Israel group, like Labour Friends of Israel, Conservative Friends of Israel, and so on, the British ambassador to Lebanon, Francis Guy, was forced to apologize for having praised Fadlallah in a blog post on July 2nd. Guy says she was very sorry for any offense her posting might have caused. A new post on the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office website said that Guy's earlier posting on the site had been an attempt to, quote, acknowledge the spiritual significance to many of Sheikh Fadlallah and the views that he held in the latter part of his life, end quote. A British Foreign Office spokesman said, however, that Guy did not reflect the British government's view. The blog was removed on Friday. Does anyone ever suffer career-impeding injuries of this type, the way Nasser and Thomas also just have, for expressing anti-Muslim or anti-Arab views? Greenwald asked. No, he answers. This speech prohibitions and thought crimes in the Middle East all run in one direction, to enforce pro-Israel orthodoxies. Sasha Polakoff-Savansky is a senior editor for Foreign Affairs, the official publication of the Council for Foreign Relations. He holds a doctorate in modern history from St. Anthony's College, Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar from 2003 to 2006, and he currently lives in Brooklyn, New York. He has written for the American Prospect, the International Herald Tribune, the New Republic, and Newsweek. His book, The Unspoken Alliance, Israel's Secret Relationship with Apartheid South Africa, was published by Pantheon in May of this year. I first met Sasha several years ago when he was doing research on that book, and had the pleasure of meeting him again in Washington last week, where we both participated in a panel discussion of Israel's nuclear arsenal, about which our politicians dare not speak, but we are free to do so. Welcome Sasha Polakoff-Savansky to Takes on the World.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Glad to have you as well. We just saw in Washington last week a continuation by President Obama of a long-standing U.S. policy of not acknowledging Israel's possession of nuclear weapons, a stance that makes the U.S. seem not only hypocritical but weak in the eyes of the world, given the demands we and others are making on Iran not to build its own weapons. How do you explain this continued silence?
Well, this is something that's been going on for decades, and I'm not sure that I fully agree with your characterization. I mean, this goes back to the Nixon era when Nixon and Golda Meir agreed, after Israel had acquired a nuclear capability, that it was going to keep it in the basement, so to speak. And the U.S. has essentially protected that special nuclear status for the last 40 years. I think that this is only likely to change when the Israelis themselves change their nuclear posture, and that's going to require a domestic debate within Israel. And I don't think that the U.S. stance is going to change dramatically until the Israelis themselves decide to reconsider their policy of nuclear opacity, as it's called, and actually declare their capability and adjust accordingly.
Well, in your book, you talk about how this has presented problems. Let's say going back, well, the policy started with Nixon, but even when Jimmy Carter was president, and Israel detonated or conducted a test in the Indian Ocean, you describe in your book how the administration did everything it possibly could to keep that story from becoming public, and acknowledging the fact that Israel actually made a test.
Yeah, well, that was in 1979, and you know, the Carter administration had an incentive to keep any nuclear test quiet, especially one that Israel was involved in. I mean, this was the time of the revolution in Iran. Carter was gearing up for a re-election campaign, and he was trying to show off his accomplishments in the field of non-proliferation, and so a nuclear flash in the South Atlantic Ocean that most people thought was South Africa at the beginning, and now it's widely believed to have been an Israeli test, probably with South African observers there, made the Carter administration look very bad, and so they tried to sweep it under the rug at the White House, but most of the scientific community and certainly the people at Los Alamos and CIA and the Pentagon had been watching this carefully, and they believed that it had, in fact, been a nuclear test, and most of the analysis that's been declassified now suggests that it couldn't have been South Africa, and my own research suggests that it could not have been South Africa in 1979 because they just weren't advanced enough to test something, and that leaves Israel.
In your book, you provide a fascinating history into the manner in which Israel and South Africa were drawn together over the years until Israel, a nation founded in the wake of the Holocaust, became a close ally of apartheid South Africa and worked with Afrikaners who had openly supported Hitler. Now, can you run that down, how that happened for our listeners?
Yeah, it's a long and complicated story, but essentially there was a real transition in the Israeli government in the late 60s and early 1970s. You have to remember that in the early days of Israel, the government was quite openly critical of the apartheid regime in South Africa. And people like Ben-Gurion and Golda Meir would speak out publicly against apartheid, and they would say things like a Jew can't be for apartheid. They would say that Israel shared a sort of post-colonial vision with the newly independent states and throughout Africa, and they were actually quite friendly. And during the 1960s, Israel ran development programs and aid programs throughout Africa. Now, this wasn't purely innocent. The Israelis certainly wanted diplomatic support at the UN, but there was really a feeling of affinity, and Golda Meir would go and visit these heads of state and openly denounce the South Africans. And it starts to change in the late 1960s, especially after the Six-Day War, when some of these African states and other groups throughout the world really start to see Israel as a colonial or imperialist power that's occupying Arab land. And people who had not necessarily been critical of Israel between 1948 and 1967 start to turn against Israel, and a lot of these African states start to align with Arab countries, especially countries like Libya and also the Gulf states, which were offering them discounted oil and all sorts of incentives. And so what you see in 1973 is a total realignment in Africa. Most of these African states break off ties with Israel during the Yom Kippur War in 1973, and Israel gets into bed with South Africa very soon after that war. And politically, what you see within Israel is a total 180 in the approach towards South Africa, and it really was a shift between generations in the Labor Party. You have this older generation of sort of socialist idealists like Meir and Ben-Gurion, and a newer generation of young technocrats, people like Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin and Moshe Dayan, who are willing to make moral compromises in order to do what they think is necessary to protect Israel's security. And for them, for that new generation in the Labor Party, getting in bed with a racist regime in Pretoria, even though the leaders of that regime had openly supported Hitler during World War II, was a compromise that they were willing to make.
Now, it's interesting, in 1973, which Israel reportedly was on the verge of using nuclear weapons against Egypt and used that threat to extort a massive conventional weapons shipment from the United States. Israel's arms merchants then fanned across the world, peddling Israeli arms to some of the worst human rights violators on the planet, besides South Africa, but in Chile, Guatemala, El Salvador, with the Contras and so on. Was there any protest against this in Israel that you're aware of, or were these sales rationalized as an economic necessity the same way working with South Africa was?
There was some protest, but it wasn't as widespread as it was elsewhere in the world. There were people in Israel, especially some of the South African Jewish resistance fighters who had moved to Israel, namely Arthur Goldreich, who was one of Nelson Mandela's closest associates and who owned a farm in the suburbs of Johannesburg in the 1960s, which was eventually raided by the South African police, and Goldreich and many key ANC leaders were arrested. Goldreich escaped from prison in 1963 and actually sought asylum in Israel, and he became the leader, one of the key leaders of the anti-apartheid movement in Israel, and by 1973, just 10 years after he'd sought exile in Israel, he was fighting against his adoptive government to stop them from signing these arms deals with his former captors. And so people like Goldreich were part of an anti-apartheid movement, and there was a small segment of the Israeli left, both in civil society and within government, in the left-wing parties and on the left-wing of the Labor Party, who always opposed this and who always spoke out against it. But it wasn't widespread, and I think that it was largely rationalized, and certainly in the press and official government statements, it was rationalized. And I want to say one more thing, Jeffrey, about 1973, because I don't think the story is quite so clear-cut. Certainly, Israel had a nuclear weapons capability at the time of the Yom Kippur War, and Israel, as you said, received a massive resupply after the first days of the Yom Kippur War, during which Israel suffered massive casualties and military hardware losses, and Israel had come to the U.S. repeatedly requesting an airlift of weaponry so that they could recover, and the U.S. at first balked and eventually did resupply them, and people have always speculated that this was because of an overt nuclear threat behind closed doors, and that's what prompted Israel to do so. My research suggests, and my conversations with people who've looked into this closely, suggest that it was a little bit more subtle than that, and there may not have been an overt statement that we intend to use nuclear weapons unless you resupply us, but sort of subtle indications, the kinds of things that military intelligence satellites pick up on, showing that Israel had these weapons and that they were mobilizing them and deploying them and prepared to use them if necessary, but not quite so overt as openly threatening to do so.
Well, I know in declassified documents that Kissinger, Israel was aware that something was happening, but Kissinger advised Israel not to be the first to strike. And there was some kind of resentment about that. But during their meetings between, I think, Kissinger and Sasha Dimitz, the Israeli minister, that they went off in some private meetings that were not recorded. And I was wondering if something might have happened in those meetings that, in which some Israeli willingness to use the bomb or being forced to use the bomb was expressed. But we could only
speculate. Yeah, it's a possibility. It's a possibility, and it's a question that many historians would love an answer to. But no one has ever come forward, and Kissinger has never come forward and reported on what actually took place in some of those closed-door meetings in October 73, and so what we're left with is statements from nuclear officials in Israel and defense officials in Israel who suggest that they displayed their ability to deploy these weapons, and that was enough to signal to the U.S. that they were serious about it.
Now you mentioned Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres seems to be on the scene from the very first day of Israel's founding, involved something or other. He was involved with the Lavon affair, which was a clumsy attempt to blow up or create fires at the U.S. and British film libraries in Egypt to make the U.S. concerned about the viability of Nasser as an ally, and there are different speculations about that. And he's a president today, but you have you introduced documents that show that he met in 1975 with South African ministers to P.W. Botha to provide Jericho missiles, nuclear weapons to South Africa. Perhaps you could talk about that.
Sure. Well, Peres has been involved in this from the very beginning. I mean, obviously, he was instrumental in getting Israel's first powerful nuclear reactor for Dimona from the French during the 1950s, and Peres almost single-handedly managed that nuclear diplomacy with France. And later on, he became the key figure in starting this relationship with South Africa after 1973. And in 1975, the specific documents you're referring to show that Peres was meeting on numerous occasions, including in Switzerland, with South Africa's defense minister, P.W. Botha, who, of course, later became the president of South Africa. And the two of them discussed various arms deals, and among those arms deals, they talked about Jericho missiles and the possibility of Israel selling nuclear-capable Jericho missiles to South Africa. And if you look at the minutes from these meetings, the fact that they're talking about nuclear weapons is quite ambiguous at first. But when you look at some of the other accompanying documents from the South African archive, including the letter that the South African chief of staff sent to his superiors the same day as the first Israeli-South African defense meeting about the Jerichos, the chief of staff in South Africa writes a very enthusiastic memo recommending that South Africa purchase these Jerichos, but only if they come with nuclear warheads, because that would be the only economical and practical use for them. And despite the very high cost, he thinks that it would be beneficial for South Africa's defense strategy. And these discussions go on for a couple of months through June 1975, and eventually the deal doesn't go through. But what's clear is that Peres was involved in these discussions and that he was willing to talk openly about a possible transfer of these nuclear missiles. And the fact that it didn't go through in the end had more to do with South Africa's own financial situation and the fact that it was expensive and South Africa had already sunk a lot of money and invested a great deal of time and energy and research in their own nuclear program, and they were getting close themselves, and so buying directly from someone else didn't seem so practical or sensible. But what the two countries did do after this aborted deal in 75 is they continued to cooperate on these Jericho missiles. And during the 1980s, many Israelis came down to South Africa, dozens of them, and they worked at a secret test range on the south coast of South Africa near Arniston, where there was ample space to test long-range weapons without anyone noticing. And that's something that Israel couldn't do in its neighborhood, and it couldn't simply fly these things out over the Mediterranean, whereas down in South Africa, there was plenty of room, and no one was expecting to find Israeli tests down there. And they also managed to help South Africa modernize its delivery systems for what it hoped to use to deliver its next generation of nuclear warheads that the South Africans were working on themselves at the time.
My guest is Sasha Polakov-Saransky. We're talking about his new book, The Unspoken Alliance, Israel's Secret Relationship with Apartheid South Africa, published by Pantheon in 2010, this just past May. One interesting thing in your book is you describe that the relationship between Israel and South Africa was far closer than most people who were even aware of the relationship imagined. And perhaps you could give some details about that.
Sure. I think many people knew, many people knew that this was going on in the 70s and 80s. I mean, you yourself, Jeffrey, and other activists who were involved in the anti-apartheid movement certainly knew that something was happening, and various activists and journalists and NGOs would publish reports on and off. The UN Special Committee Against Apartheid would publish reports, but it was all based on speculation, on circumstantial evidence. There wasn't any really hard archival evidence or key figures speaking on the record about this, and so there was a general idea of what was going on, and a document or two would leak out every once in a while, and there were some books written about this relationship during the 1980s. But no one had ever really seen the internal documentary record, and so people tended to underestimate what was actually going on, and because it was hidden so well, it was easy for the Israelis and the South Africans to deny the extent of what was going on. And as you know, the Israeli government and various organizations throughout the world, and especially in the United States, tried to cover this up during the 80s and invested a lot of time and energy in covering it up. If you look at the publications of the ADL and the American Jewish Committee and British Jewish organizations during the 1980s, everyone was trying to downplay the extent of this relationship and say, oh, yeah, Israel trades with South Africa a little bit, but it's insignificant compared to other Western countries, and it's insignificant compared to black African states who trade with South Africa. And of course they were wrong, because they were using incomplete IMF data that didn't account for arms sales, and it didn't account for diamonds, and it didn't account for uranium, so of course it looked minuscule if you looked at that incomplete data. And so the journalists who were trying to write about this knew that obviously it was much bigger than the deniers were saying, but no one really had a handle on how big it was. And what I've tried to do in this book is actually put a price tag on it. And I think that my figure is low, too, because it doesn't account for all of the joint research and development and joint financing arrangements. But if you look purely at the purchasing data from the South African parastatal arms organization, which is called Arms Corps, we're talking about $10 billion over a 20-year period of direct transfers from Israel to South Africa. And when you add in the joint financing arrangements and these joint projects like the Jericho missile project in Arniston, the figure is probably far greater.
You brought up the response to the American Jewish community, and that's when the reference to that, we met some years back to get information, because I was one of those investigated and spied on by the Anti-Defamation League, whose lead spy was spying on anti-apartheid organizations for both the Anti-Defamation League as well as South African intelligence. And there was an attempt to not only defend Israel from charges that it was colluding with South Africa, but to smear anyone who supported, took that position as being anti-Semitic. I remember even Bishop Tutu came to the United States and spoke about that, and the American Jewish Committee called him anti-Semitic for even raising the issue, and even the members of the Congressional Black Caucus were cowed into silence over this issue. So while there was some discussions within Congress, there wasn't strong action taken. It was not a bright moment in American congressional history.
Right.
One thing to get back to the information you got, how were you able to get so much information that heretofore was not accessible?
Mostly in South Africa, when it comes to the actual military relationship, the Israelis are very reluctant to let any documents out about this, even if the stuff is more than 30 years old and technically subject to declassification. If it's controversial and sensitive and something that makes Israel look bad, chances are you're not going to get it. And so my archival evidence comes exclusively from South Africa, but it's important to note that the South Africans kept really meticulous records, and so much of what you find in the South African Defense Ministry archive is actually from the Israeli side. And what I mean by that is that the South Africans kept the Israeli side of the correspondence. So they were writing back and forth to each other, discussing various arms deals, and generals like Ariel Sharon were writing to their counterparts in South Africa, and they were congratulating one another on various operations and what they saw as accomplishments in the fight against a common enemy. They really saw the ANC and the PLO as one and the same. And so all of this is in the South African archive, so you're really able to read the Israeli archive through the South African one, so to speak. And I got about 7,000 pages of documents from the Defense Ministry in South Africa, a few thousand more from the Foreign Ministry in South Africa. And so when you put this together, you get quite a complete picture of what was going on.
You report how during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, how South African generals were invited to come to the Israeli lines while the Israelis were shelling Beirut and conducting their operations. And in turn, Israelis were invited to go with South African Defense Forces into Angola during the fight there, at the time when the Cubans had come in, were fighting on the side of the MPLA in Angola.
Yeah, it was a very close relationship, and they were willing to take each other to the front lines, as you said. In some cases, the Israelis would invite the South Africans before they even invited Americans to go and view the battlefield. And after the Israelis took out the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981, the Israeli Defense Force shared the footage of the operation with the South Africans. And the only other country they had shared that footage with was the United States. And in South Africa, the relationship was so close that the South Africans really relied on their Israeli visitors for advice on how to handle the situation in Angola. And they would fly them up there in military helicopters to view what was going on and seek their advice on almost everything. And you know, I heard this firsthand from the Israeli generals who had served in South Africa and went on these trips and gave advice to the South Africans.
One thing we should mention, and you mentioned in your talk in Washington, the importance of South Africa providing yellow cake uranium from the late 60s, the early 70s, in exchange for, I mean, it was tritium, which is enhances the power of particular weapons. Maybe you could talk about that, the yellow cake exchange, because we heard all about yellow cake during the build-up to the Iraq War.
Sure. Well, yellow cake is uranium oxide, essentially, and it's the first ingredient in the enrichment process. After a lengthy process, can produce highly enriched uranium, or in the case of a country like Israel that built bombs from plutonium, it can be used in uranium fuel rods that are later reprocessed to produce plutonium. And South Africa was providing this to Israel through the 1960s and into the 1970s, and it was quite a vital source for the Israelis. And many people who have looked at this relationship in the past sort of assume that it's a one-way street and that Israel was supplying vital weaponry to apartheid South Africa, which of course is true, but it was actually a two-way street, and the Israelis were getting something out of it too, not just a massive amount of money because of the large South African export market, but also this yellow cake uranium from South Africa. And South Africa obviously has rich natural resources, mineral resources from gold to platinum to uranium, and they began shipping this to Israel in the early 1960s, and they had a bilateral safeguards agreement, which meant that South Africa could send inspectors to Israel to make sure that the Israelis were only using it for peaceful or research purposes and not for any military purposes. And this lasted up until 1976, and in 76, the Israeli intelligence establishment asked the South Africans to drop the safeguards so that they could use it at Dimona. And the South Africans sent their mining minister, a man named Fani Bosa, to Israel, and he met with Peres, he met with Rabin, he met with the leading nuclear officials, some other leading generals, and he lifted the safeguards. And he confessed this to me in a long interview 5 years ago in South Africa. And essentially what that did is open up this very large stockpile of over 500 tons of South African uranium that had built up from the early 60s through 1976 in Israel, and suddenly the Israelis were able to use it in their nuclear weapons program. And in return, they provided South Africa with tritium, which is a nuclear material that enhances the explosive power of thermonuclear weapons, and the South Africans had hoped to use this in some of the future weapons that they were researching and developing at the time. And they also, more importantly, in my view, funneled money to this minister in South Africa. The Israelis funneled money to Fani Bota because he was facing personal bankruptcy, and they were very afraid that if that came out in the press, it would end Fani Bota's political career, and he might lose this very important portfolio in the cabinet before this yellow cake for tritium deal went through, and they wanted to keep him financially solvent until the deal was consummated. And so they funneled money through an intermediary to Fani Bota, and all of this came out in an extortion trial in the South African Supreme Court in the late 1980s, and this trial was kept under wraps. It was held in camera and highly classified, but when the document leaked, you got a fuller picture of this whole nuclear transaction between Israel and South Africa and the element of corruption that was involved in it as well.
My guest is Sasha Polakoff-Saransky, and I'm going to open the phone in just a moment. I want to get one more question. What has the response been to your book in Israel, and what has your response been to your book and within the American Jewish community?
To be honest, I haven't heard a whole lot from the American Jewish organizations. I think they're angrier about Peter Beinart's recent article in the New York Review of Books than they are about my book. But in Israel, the response has been interesting. It hasn't been as negative as I expected. Obviously, Peres came out the day before the book was released and denied all of the charges about his participation in these nuclear talks, because The Guardian in London ran a big story about these allegations on May 24th. And so Peres immediately denied that, and that made it a very big news story in Israel. So a lot of the Israeli radio stations and newspapers wanted to talk to me about it, and they were very open and curious. And one reason, I think, is that it's not so easy in the Israeli media to talk about Israel's nuclear weapons program, because it's a taboo and it's not officially acknowledged, and there are military censorship rules governing what can be said in the press there. But when a foreign source reports it, or even an Israeli residing abroad reports this sort of thing, then they're free to re-report it. And so it was an opportunity to discuss the Israeli nuclear weapons program that doesn't always occur. So the Israeli press has actually been very receptive and offered me space to respond to critics when people have attacked me in newspapers there. So the response there has been quite favorable, I'd say.
But you say that it has not been, you have not been interviewed, or you have not seen reviews in the American Jewish press so far.
In the American Jewish press, that's not entirely true. I mean, the Forward in New York did a story about the book that was actually quite positive, but I haven't received angry emails or negative comments from major American Jewish organizations, which I thought I might.
Well, yeah, actually, the Forward is unique among the Jewish publications, because it actually is one of the, it gives you a really good idea of what is going on in the American Jewish community, and it's also critical of the American Jewish community, some stands as well as of Israel, which is kind of unique in the American Jewish press.
Yeah, yeah. There's also a new magazine called Tablet that's published online, and they had Benjamin Pogren, who is a famous South African opposition journalist, review the book, and he wrote a review in Tablet online soon after it came out. So places like Tablet and the Forward have been receptive here.
My guest is Sasha Polakoff-Saransky. If you have any comments or questions, you know the number here is 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. You mentioned, although it's not part of the subject, an article by Peter Beinart in the New York Review of Books, and perhaps you could tell our listeners, this is an article that's caused extreme amount of discussion and controversy within the American Jewish community. So perhaps you might comment on that, what exactly that's about, so people might check it out.
Yeah, it's a very important article, and it started an overdue debate, in my opinion. And essentially, Peter argues that the American Jewish organizations, sort of the official organs of the community, like the Anti-Defamation League and the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations and so on, have carved out such a narrow right-wing definition of what it means to be pro-Israel that younger American Jews no longer identify with Israel. And whereas in the past, a young college graduate from the U.S. might go work on a kibbutz in Israel, today they're going to work for the Obama campaign, or they're going to work for Greenpeace or a number of other organizations. And his explanation for that shift is that my generation, people in their 20s and 30s in this country are no longer able to identify with Israel, because the people who are calling themselves pro-Israel and supposedly representing a pro-Israel position are essentially adopting a pro-Likud position. And so people who may have in the past supported Israel no longer are, and that this generation has trouble sort of reconciling their parents' political liberalism with Zionism, because the brand of Zionism that they see on display today is so aggressive and militaristic that they no longer identify with it.
Well, it's interesting, going back to your book, you mentioned that once Likud came into power, when Begin was elected in 77, there was no more constraints in terms of Israel's relationship with South Africa. The arguments, the controversies that had existed when Labor was associating, when Peres was associating with South Africa, then disappeared in a sense.
It did, because there wasn't as much of an internal debate. The Labor Party at least had a left wing that served as a brake, to some extent, on what the government could do, or at least as a dissenting voice. And, these people never really went away and were there in the 1980s criticizing the relationship. But in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a consensus within the Israeli right that, this was good for Israel, and there wasn't so much concern with the moral side of the equation, and people who may have had some moral qualms during the late 60s and early 70s, people in the Labor Party who wanted to at least pretend that they were carrying forth the torch of Ben-Gurion and Golda Meir, no longer had to do that. And so someone like Peres, who always publicly denounced apartheid and said that it was a horrible thing that Israel couldn't support South Africa, was behind the scenes a key figure in furthering this relationship. And he had to sort of carry on this doublespeak, in order to pay tribute to the founders of the Labor Party and at the same time carry on the policy that he was promoting. But when Begin and these guys came to power, they didn't feel an obligation to pay tribute to the founders of the State of Israel and this more moral vision of foreign policy in Africa. They just went ahead and increased their ties with South Africa, both in terms of trade and military exchanges and sending people back and forth, but also, as I mentioned earlier, in these letters that people like Sharon were writing back and forth with their counterparts in South Africa and really praising the South Africans for what they were doing and expressing a sense of that they understood them and that they saw themselves as fighting a common enemy.
In a sense, they were surrounded. This is like a European settler colony surrounded by natives who were threatening to overrun the colony, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, that was how it was framed. And people in the Israeli military establishment, it certainly wasn't everyone, and I want to stress that. I mean, there was always this left-wing voice in Israel that denounced the relationship and wanted it to end, but for a certain portion of the military elite and the Likud leadership, there was a sense that they faced a common lot, and that South Africa and Israel were in the same boat, and that the Arabs want to push the Jews into the sea, and the blacks want to push the whites into the sea in South Africa, and we have to do everything in our capacity to resist that by any means necessary. And these guys really saw the world the same way, and they would write to each other back and forth about that. And when the South Africans staged a raid in Angola and killed various rebels but also hundreds of civilians, the Israelis would congratulate them, and vice versa when the Israelis did things like that in Lebanon. When Sharon had to step down after the Sabra and Shatila massacres, his counterparts in South Africa wrote to him with great sympathy, saying, we're so sorry that this is happening, and we commend you for the good job that you've done.
One thing I actually meant to mention earlier, it wasn't just through the Israeli army and Israeli arms dealers that the deals with South Africa were going on. The Israeli Labor Federation histadrut which at that time owned a number of corporations, Israeli corporations, as well as some kibbutzes, which even one, I remember, had Holocaust survivors, were manufacturing items for Homeland Security use before the name became well known, that were selling to South Africa. Maybe you comment on that.
Well, the Histadrut had a sort of complicated role in this, because in the mid-1980s, they actually helped fund some of the first contacts between the Israeli left and black South African opposition groups, and brought various black South African opposition leaders to Israel for leadership training and this sort of thing. And it was actually quite controversial at the time, but it was an effort on the part of the Israeli government to start talking to the other side, and it occurred because of pressure from the left. People like Yossi Beilin and Alon Liel and Shimshon Zelniker, who really saw the writing on the wall for the apartheid regime and saw that Israel had thrown in its lot with the wrong side in this conflict, and they were trying to reach out to some of these black South African groups. So later on, the Histadrut and the Israeli labor movement actually starts to play quite an important role in transforming the relationship and sort of setting up the first initial contacts with the ANC and other key South African groups. And in fact, it's interesting, when they started doing this, the South African intelligence agencies actually monitored Histadrut representatives who were going to South Africa to meet with blacks, because they were worried that Israel was essentially starting to change sides. And of course, this didn't really ever happen. Israel imposed sanctions on South Africa in 1987 after the U.S. imposed sanctions and essentially forced Israel to, by threatening to cut off aid to people who violated the arms embargo against South Africa. But by the early 1990s, as the transition was moving forward, Israeli officials were talking to ANC officials, and some of this early contact through the labor movement helped set this up, so that when the transition occurred in 1994, the relationship wasn't so frosty and negative. And in fact, in the first years, both before the transition and immediately afterwards, the Israeli relationship with South Africa was actually quite good, because the ambassadors that Israel sent down there were key figures from the left who had always opposed apartheid.
My guest today has been Sasha Polakoff-Saransky, whose new book, The Unspoken Alliance, Israel's Secret Relationship with Apartheid South Africa, just came out in May by Pantheon Books. I would advise, we have some wonderful local bookstores here in Mendocino County. If they do not have the book, please ask them for the book, because it is a fascinating read to tell you history that's quite important for our time, considering the situation of nuclear weapons and proliferation. Sasha, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Takes on the World. It was good to see you again in Washington last week.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye. And that was Sasha Polakoff-Saransky. And you heard it on Takes on the World. Stay tuned for Earth and Sky, followed by Jim Denton and Beyond Bach. And you have heard all of this on KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Williston, Ukiah, and 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, and on the World Wide Web at kzyx.org.